Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are on a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you very much, Stephanie, and I too would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect workshop. And today's program is focusing on lung cancer and immuno-oncology, and we're focusing today on managing the side effects of immuno-oncology and the treatment of lung cancer. And this is part two of a two-part series, and today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations and also lung cancer organizations. And we are delighted with your response to our program today. We have on the program today over 697 participants. You come from all over the United States. And we also have international participants from Canada, Brazil, Italy, the United Kingdom, and Venezuela. So you really come from all over the world. And it's really a credit to you that you've chosen to spend the next hour with us. And today's program has been made possible by Bristol-Myers Squibb, a contribution from Lilly, and supported by a grant from Genentech and Astellas US LLC. And I really want to thank them for their support of the program today, but also for their corporate partnership making this program possible. Now, we have wonderful speakers on our program today, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker, and our first speaker is Dr. Heather Wakely. Dr. Wakely is Associate Professor, Department of Medicine, Division of Oncology, Stanford University, Stanford Cancer Institute. And Dr. Wakely is going to address how the side effects of immunotherapy differ from chemotherapy side effects, tips to deal with flu-like symptoms, including fever, and dealing with fatigue, diarrhea, and dehydration, and guidelines for follow-up care. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Wakely.
Thanks, Carolyn. It's great to be here and to be able to address such a wide audience. I just wanted to start by talking about the enthusiasm we all have for this new class of anti-cancer agents. I remember when I started treating lung cancer patients over a decade ago, we really didn't have anything that we could offer beyond chemotherapy. Now, chemotherapy still plays an important role in the treatment of lung cancer, but we have a lot of new options available as well. And the latest wave of new options are the so-called immune therapies. And the immune therapies are working by trying to get the immune system of the body to recognize and attack cancer cells. That has been a dream for a long time, but we're finally entering the reality of being able to prescribe these drugs for patients with lung cancer. We just came back from our annual meeting known as ASCO, the American Society of Clinical Oncology meeting, and that's a meeting of over 30,000 people involved in the treatment of cancer. And one of the highlights of this meeting was discussions about immunotherapy, and treatment of immunotherapy for lung cancer was particularly highlighted. And there are a number of new drugs, one of which is already now approved by the FDA for the treatment of lung cancer, and others that are in later stages of development. And I'm just going to mention those briefly and then talk specifically about side effects that we need to be watching with these drugs. They are showing tremendous promise, but unfortunately do have a few side effects we need to watch for as well, just as we do with any of our cancer therapies. So the drugs I'm going to be talking about are called the checkpoint inhibitors, and checkpoint just refers to the different ways the immune system works. So just to remind the audience, in order to have a functioning immune system, the immune cells have to be able to recognize anything that's foreign. So traditionally, that's going to be bacteria, viruses, and cancer cells, but not recognize normal cells, not attack self. And it's that ability to distinguish between self and not self that allows us to have such a great ability to destroy bacteria, viruses, and usually cancer cells without causing a lot of problems. When the immune system is not working quite well enough, people are more prone to getting infections or cancer. And when it's working too well, we end up getting what we call autoimmune diseases. So most people have heard of rheumatoid arthritis or lupus. Mild allergies are a form of that as well. And so when we get into talking about these drugs that are trying to get the immune system to work better against cancer, it's important to keep that issue in mind, that when the immune system works too well, it can lead to these autoimmune diseases, and that's really the root of the toxicities that we see with these drugs. So the way that they're working is, I mentioned they're called checkpoint inhibitors, and that's because the regulation on the immune system is to keep it from recognizing self too often. And to do that, it uses a variety of different signaling techniques. But one is called PD-1 and PD-L1. That stands for program death ligand is the PDL, and program death is just the names of those receptors and ligands. And I don't want to make it too complicated, but basically when a PD-1 signal from an immune cell hits a PD-L1 signal on a cancer cell, that kind of turns off the immune cell. It's one of those stop signals. And so normal tissue has a lot of PD-L1 on it as a stop signal to say, if there's an immune cell coming here, go away, I'm normal, I'm normal self. So cancer cells have figured that out as one way of evading the immune system. If they have a lot of PD-L1 signal, when the immune cell comes in to attack the cancer cells, it sees that PD-L1, which basically is like a stop sign, and it backs away. But if we interact, you know, if we block that interaction with these new drugs, then that PD-1, PD-L1 interaction doesn't happen because it's blocked by the new drugs. Then the immune cell doesn't see the tumor as anything other than foreign, and it can attack it. So that's sort of it's important for people to understand why that's working. So these drugs are hitting PD-1 or PD-L1, so some way to block that interaction. And the drug that's now made it onto the market is called nivolumab, and that's hitting PD-1. So what happens is if someone with cancer gets an infusion of this nivolumab, what it's doing is it's binding and blocking PD-1. And when the PD-1 is bound that way, it can't bind with the PD-L1. Therefore, it's stopping that negative signal. Therefore, the immune system attacks the cancer a little bit more. And so that was the theory behind this drug, and now we know it works. At first, it was shown to work in melanoma cancer, and now it's been shown to work in lung cancer. And the reason we know it works is we just heard the results of two really big studies, one in the type of lung cancer known as squamous, and one in the type of lung cancer that was everything that wasn't squamous, so adeno and large cell. And in those two trials, in both cases, the nivolumab treatment, which is an IV given every 2 weeks, was compared to regular chemotherapy. It was a chemotherapy drug called docetaxel. And in both of the trials, the patients getting nivolumab were more likely to have a response than they were to the regular chemo, and that response seemed to last longer and people were living longer. So that was very encouraging. And that led to approval of this drug, nivolumab, for squamous lung cancer. Because the other trial in non-squamous was also positive, we expect that we'll be able to use this drug in patients with any kind of lung cancer in the near future. But as I mentioned, it does have some side effects, and that was really the focus of our talk today, is what are these side effects and how can people getting these drugs and caregivers who are helping patients getting these drugs know what to look for. As we talked about, these drugs are working to rev up the immune system. And when you rev up the immune system against the cancer, you run that risk of revving it up against normal self as well. And so the side effects that are seen reflect that. People who are getting these drugs usually tolerate them very well. There are very few side effects, but occasionally the immune system gets extra active. And then you can get side effects like diarrhea if it's attacking the gut, or difficulty breathing if the immune system starts to attack the lung. Fatigue, if it starts to attack the endocrine system, causing hormone changes, causing, say, like thyroid changes in the thyroid function. Liver tests can get changed. So there's any organ in the body can potentially be affected. Though, again, it's very, very rare. So I don't want to scare the audience, but it's just important for people to be mindful, aware of these things as they start on these drugs. So the most common effect is just fatigue. When fatigue is happening, sometimes we can figure out the reason by looking at hormones, like the thyroid hormone. Most of the time, though, we aren't able to come up with a clear answer. And in that case, we have to deal with standard ways of dealing with fatigue, and that's going to be making sure a patient's getting adequate rest, but not too much rest. So a nap during the day is great. A lot of naps during the day often leads to decreased activity and being more fatigued paradoxically. So good to have a nap, but good to limit it to maybe 20, 30 minutes at a time. Exercise, paradoxically, actually leads to increases in energy. So people who are able to get a little bit of exercise, no need to go out and run a marathon or anything like that, but just to get out and walk, that actually can help with keeping up your energy a lot. It's one of the most important things that we can recommend. And obviously getting a good healthy diet. So to help combat fatigue, which is by far the most common symptom with these drugs and usually fairly mild, the best thing one can do is make sure you're getting good sleep at night. If need be, taking a nap, but not a long nap and not a lot of naps, and then trying to get a little bit of exercise every day. Those are the things that can really make a difference. Occasionally, people will feel a little flu-y, like they're getting a flu when they get these drugs. Pretty rare, and that would be just usual symptom management. Again, if this is happening, you do want to make sure that you've checked with your healthcare team, that they've looked to make sure you don't have any of these autoimmune reactions that would perhaps lead to thyroid function or adrenal function problems. That's not usually going to happen, but it's good to just be aware of it and to have looked. Assuming that's not going on, then it's going to be supportive management, making sure that you stay hydrated, rest as we just talked about, but getting a little exercise. You can take the usual medications like acetaminophen or Tylenol to help control any sort of flu-like symptoms. The other side effects, as I mentioned, are rare, but we need to be very aware of them. So the things that we worry about a lot would be if someone starts to develop significant diarrhea. Significant diarrhea from these drugs, what we call technically is colitis. If that happens, it can lead to very severe dehydration. Again, if it's caught early, the ways that we treat it are to use things that suppress the immune system, such as steroids. And with recognition of a colitis early, if steroids are started early, and perhaps holding the immune drug, usually there's a good recovery from that. So it's just something, again, to if someone were to start getting diarrhea, you can take the usual things like Imodium, or other over-the-counter anti-diarrhea medications, but very important to let your healthcare team know, because if it is a more severe reaction, it's important that you're started on steroid medications very quickly. The other organ that we worry about in lung cancer, of course, is the lung. And when these drugs like nivolumab were first being developed, the idea that these autoimmune reactions could occur were not as understood. And so there were a few patients who developed significant autoimmune reactions in the lung, known as a pneumonitis, that led to some serious complications. However, now that we recognize that and can look for it, most people really don't have any significant problems from it. But what we encourage people to do is to just be aware, and as they're starting on these drugs, if they start noticing that they're developing worsening breathing symptoms, it's very important to let the healthcare team know quickly. If it's a very mild symptom or just something that's seen on a chest x-ray a little bit, you can potentially delay therapy, monitor people, and they tend to do fairly well. If it gets to be more significant, then patients might need to come in the hospital and get a dose of steroids for a little bit of time and to be worked up to make sure that that's truly what's happening and it isn't an infection, which sometimes can look like this pneumonitis. If it gets very severe, then patients definitely have to be hospitalized, definitely need high-dose steroids, but there's a very good chance for recovery. And so it just, the most important thing I wanted to go through today was just for people to be very mindful of this risk of these autoimmune diseases like the colitis, or, which is the diarrhea, or the pneumonitis, which is the lung inflammation. If we know about these and are watching for them, patients tend to do very, very well without any need for a long-term treatment related to that. But it is important for people to just be thinking about this, because with chemotherapy, we're more used to thinking about hair loss, we're used to thinking about nausea and vomiting, we're used to thinking about risk for infection. And with these newer immune drugs, we're not seeing those sorts of side effects. We're not seeing hair loss. We're not seeing nausea and vomiting, which is great. And we are still seeing some fatigue, but tends to be less than we see with chemotherapy. But it's just in a small number of patients that we can have these very unusual but very severe, if not recognized and treated early, immune-related side effects. But awareness of that leads to very good control. One of the other effects that we see, of course, is in the skin. And our next speaker, Dr. Choi, is going to be spending some time going over management of skin conditions related to these autoimmune potentially causing drugs, but the immune-targeted chemotherapies known as nivolumab especially. And then I mentioned that there's several others in development. Pembrolizumab is one that's already approved for melanoma and will likely be seeing approved for lung cancer at some point in the near future. And then there are also multiple drugs that are targeting what's the PD-L1. Remember, I mentioned there's the PD-1 side and the PD-L1 side. So those drugs are also looking very promising in reports that were presented at this ASCO meeting we just came from. So with that, I'm going to close and turn it over for discussion of the skin toxicities to Dr. Choi.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Wakely. That was an outstanding presentation, really just lots of important material for everybody, and I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. Thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. Jennifer Choi. Dr. Choi is Assistant Professor of Dermatology, Yale School of Medicine, Director, Yale Oncodermatology Clinic, Smilow Cancer Hospital at Yale New Haven. Hospital. And Dr. Choi is going to address managing rash, dry skin, and itching, caring for your skin during immunotherapy, sun safety tips, and communicating with the healthcare team about quality of life concerns. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Choi.
So I will be talking about managing rash, dry skin, and itching, as well as talking about certain side effects that you can see in your skin, how to care for your skin during immunotherapy, including sun safety tips, as well as communicating with your healthcare team about quality of life concerns. So while the focus of today's conference is side effects of immunotherapy for lung cancer, I'm going to talk about common side effects that can occur both from immunotherapy and other common treatments for lung cancer, which often include EGFR inhibitors such as erlotinib, otherwise known as Tarceva, or cetuximab, otherwise known as Erbitux. So skin side effects from immunotherapy are fairly common. Let's start with rash. So rash is reported due to anti-PD-1 therapy such as nivolumab and pembrolizumab in approximately 15 to 20% of patients. This rash can look like several different things. Sometimes it appears as numerous small pink or red bumps, what we call papules, that can come together in broader patches. This can involve the scalp, face, trunk, and arms and legs, in addition to hands and feet. And sometimes, instead of being broad, people can develop just a smaller number of these individual pink or red papules. Frequently, these lesions can be scaly and associated with itching, and usually the itching is fairly mild. So in general, the rash does not tend to be severe enough to stop therapy. If you do develop a rash, you should notify your oncologist or care practitioner or dermatologist if available, and they can prescribe a topical steroid. Over-the-counter topical steroids such as hydrocortisone 1% cream sometimes can work if the rash is very mild, but if the rash is associated with a higher degree of itching or seems to be more severe, then you do need a prescription-strength topical steroid. These are used frequently and usually applied twice a day for approximately 2 weeks, and it can really help to make the rash go away and get better. If the rash is severe, then cancer treatment is held until the rash improves, and sometimes systemic steroids given either as oral prednisone or sometimes in severe cases intravenously, they may be needed to treat the rash, but again, only if the rash is very severe. Usually, if systemic steroids are needed, there's a slow taper of over about 4 weeks, because if the steroids are stopped too soon, the rash can flare back up again. Itching and dry skin are also common. Pruritus, which is the formal name for itching, is reported to occur in approximately 17 to 20% of patients on immunotherapy. There are several measures that can be taken to manage itching, which is frequently associated with dry skin. So you want to use an emollient that is alcohol-free. You want to be sure that you use a cream which comes in tubes or tubs and not a lotion, which is frequently found in a pump. Creams are thicker and better moisturizers than lotions. Cool compresses can be helpful on the skin for 5 to 10 minutes multiple times a day to reduce itching. And also oatmeal baths can be helpful. These are sold as packets over the counter, and then you can dissolve them in a warm bathtub and then basically just go in and soak for anywhere from, you know, 10 to 15 minutes. You want to try to avoid very hot water. You know, sometimes people with itching, they say the hot water can actually temporarily make their skin feel better and reduce the itching. But ultimately, if you do use very hot water, it can dry your skin out more and lead to even worse itching. So you do want to try to stick with lukewarm water and also limit the amount of time that you're in the bathtub or the shower, because long amounts of time can also dry out your skin in the end. Gentle skincare measures are also very helpful with anyone with dry or itchy skin, and these include the following. So you want to use a gentle soap in the bath or shower. Avoid anything that is harsh or fragranced in terms of soaps. For example, Dove Sensitive Skin Soap is a good choice. There's something called Cetaphil Cleanser, which is really not a soap, but it's a cleanser. These are two good examples. You want to avoid anything that has an obvious fragrance, because this can irritate the skin. So you do want to look for something that says non-fragrance. After a shower or bath, you can towel dry and then apply a generous layer of this emollient cream, of an emollient cream all over. And you want to repeat moisturizing at least twice a day. You also want to look at the detergent that you're using to wash your clothes, because it also should be fragrance and dye-free. There are many detergents now that say free and clear on the bottle, and that indicates that there are no perfumes or dyes in the product. So you want to stay away from the detergents that actually make your clothes smell nice. And you also want to avoid dryer sheets in the clothes dryer, because that can also get onto your clothes and then irritate your skin more. So for itching or dry skin, you also can ask your care provider for a prescription topical steroid, again, if it's severe. Even if there is not a rash, sometimes 1 to 2 weeks of using a topical steroid can be quite helpful in reducing itching. The other thing that can be helpful in reducing itching is using systemic antihistamines. So some of these are very effective that can be found over the counter. These include loratadine, which is known as Claritin, cetirizine, which is known as Zyrtec, or fexofenadine, which is known as Allegra. Other antihistamines that are more sedating, they can make you feel sleepy, but they can be helpful, particularly at night, to help you fall asleep. And these include Benadryl, and there is a prescription that is called hydroxyzine. So these are things that you can ask your care provider about. And then if itching is severe and, you know, one of these antihistamines don't work, then sometimes we do recommend that you even use multiple antihistamines at the same time, or there can be other prescription medications that are stronger that can be used, and you can ask your care provider about that as well. So the side effects from EGFR inhibitors are both similar and different from those of immunotherapy. So in terms of rash with EGFR inhibitors, it does appear different. There's a very characteristic acne-like rash that is composed of inflamed red bumps and pustules, and it occurs in as many as 45 to 90% of patients. Now, this most frequently involves the central face, scalp, the middle of the chest, the middle of the back, and less commonly involves the extremities, abdomen, and buttocks. The rash can start as early as 2 to 4 weeks into treatment, and sometimes there can be a bacterial component that can make the rash appear more inflamed. So when you're evaluated for this rash, it's wise for the care practitioner to take a bacterial culture to make sure that there's no signs of infection. In addition, you know, in the midst of the rash, if the rash is mild, then treatment usually consists of moisturization with an emollient, with a cream. If it's more severe, then a prescription for either a topical or oral antibiotic along with a topical steroid can be very helpful, which you would usually apply twice a day for 2 to 4 weeks. There have been some studies showing that an oral antibiotic, such as doxycycline or minocycline, if it started at the same time as the EGFR inhibitor, it can prevent the rash or make it less severe from the beginning. So you can ask about having this prescribed, or a lot of times people will just wait to see if the rash develops, at which point it can be treated at that time with an antibiotic or a steroid cream. Another side effect from EGFR inhibitors includes inflammation of the skin around the nails, known as paronychia. This can cause pain, sometimes along with oozing. So you should have your doctor look at this and see if topical or oral antibiotics might be needed. And again, sometimes a topical steroid for this can be helpful as well. If this occurs, you should also make sure to keep the affected finger or toe away from pressure or friction, because that can really make it worse. So, for example, you want to wear shoes that are not too tight or constricting. You want to try to keep the affected area open to air as much as possible when you're out and about, like, say, at home. And sometimes soaking in distilled vinegar soaks. So what this is you basically take distilled white vinegar, one part to two parts warm water. So if you're going to fill a small basin, you want to take one cup of distilled white vinegar to two cups of warm water. And then you can soak your feet or your fingers for 5 to 10 minutes a few times a day. And this can help keep the area clean and also to dry it out, particularly if it's oozing. If the area is bleeding or has excessive, something we call granulation tissue, which is moist pink or red tissue around the nail, then the doctor should look at it, and they can treat it with something that can help to dry out that tissue. Sometimes they use something called silver nitrate or another type of solution to help to dry it out. Another common side effect is fissures of the fingertips and toes or feet. This occurs due to the skin getting extremely dry from the EGFR inhibitor treatment. So helpful tips for this is making sure that you keep your hands and feet very moisturized several times a day with a good emollient cream. For the actual fissures, you want to cover them with an ointment such as Vaseline or Aquaphor ointment and cover them with a bandage. So it's not enough just to apply the ointment, but you really need to cover it with a bandage. Sometimes people do find helpful something called finger cots, which are rubber or silicone glove tips to cover the fingers with the ointment underneath. And these can be found over the counter at your local pharmacy. If you do cover the fissure with a bandage, try not to get them wet, because if they do get wet, keeping that wet bandage on there can actually make the fissure worse. So you want to replace the ointment and cover with a new dry bandage. And so a lot of times that means keeping the ointment with a stack of bandages in your pocket so that you can replace them when needed. And usually if you do this, it will take about 2 to 3 to 4 days, sometimes up to a week for deep fissures to heal, but they usually do heal. And again, if they're very painful, then you can ask your doctor to prescribe a topical steroid ointment, which can also help these to heal faster. Another side effect that patients can develop are eyelashes becoming very long. They can also become curly and coarse and thickened. If they get too long or start to irritate the eyelashes or eyes, you can have somebody help you with carefully trimming the eyelashes. If there's irritation of your eyes, your doctor can prescribe a topical steroid or antibiotic that can help. You may also notice over time that even the hair on your scalp can become curly and brittle as well. And then finally, some people can develop mucositis, which is erosions or irritation of inside the mouth, including the gums, insides of the cheeks, or the tongue. If this happens, it can be painful and it can, really make eating troublesome, but a couple things can help, such as rinsing with a combination of baking soda and just a little bit of salt water to help to keep the area clean. There's also something that is called Paradex mouthwash, which contains an ingredient called chlorhexidine. This can also help to keep the area clean. And if the mucositis is very severe, then a prescription topical steroid gel can be prescribed and used twice a day, which can help to heal the sores. So in terms of sun safety tips, whenever someone is on chemotherapy, the skin or immunotherapy, the skin can become more sensitive to the sun. That means it's easier to get a sunburn, or it's easier for your skin to get irritated just from sun exposure. So sun protection measures during cancer treatment are very important, and there are a few practical tips that are useful to optimize your skin protection from the dangers of sun exposure. So you want to use a daily sunscreen that is labeled as broad spectrum, which covers both UVA and UVB sun rays, and the sunscreen should be a minimum of SPF 30. So SPF, you'll see this term on all the sunscreen bottles. It stands for sun protection factor. SPF 30 screens out 97% of the sun's UVB rays. SPF 50 screens out 98%. So anything above SPF 50 really is not necessary. If it says broad spectrum, you can be assured that it's covering both UVB and UVA rays. There are two different types. There are some sunscreens that contain something called chemical blockers, which basically absorb the sun rays, and these go by ingredients such as avobenzone or oxybenzone. The ones that are sometimes preferred in patients undergoing cancer treatment are the ones that contain physical blockers, and this works immediately, and it works by bouncing off the sun rays, and they tend to cause less irritation of your skin. So while you're undergoing cancer treatment, it's better to look for the physical blockers. These are the ones that contain something called zinc oxide or titanium dioxide. And it does not necessarily mean that your skin will turn white from the cream. There are several that now you can rub into your skin and it does not appear white. But just make sure you look on the back of the bottle to look for zinc oxide or titanium dioxide. You want to make sure that you're applying at least a shot glass full to all your sun-exposed areas of the face and body. So if you're wearing shorts and a T-shirt and you're covering your face, your ears, your neck, your arms, and your legs, it should be at least one full shot glass, which is one fluid ounce. If you're exposing more than that, it should be even more than that. You want to reapply every 2 hours, and if you're swimming or perspiring or toweling off, you want to reapply even more than that. So make sure you reapply because a lot of people forget, and then they can get sunburned later. Also, you want to just, if you're using a spray, it's okay to use a spray. Just make sure you're not breathing it in as it's being sprayed. And also, you want to spray it evenly onto the skin and still rub it in. The other thing is the importance of using sunscreens year-round. UVB rays are most intense in the summer, but UVA rays are equal intensity throughout the year. So even on a sunny day, you can get sunburned, so just make sure you're using sunscreens year-round. Other helpful measures are seeking shade, so, you know, staying in the shade any between especially 10 a.m. and 2 p.m., because that's when the sun is most intense. And then as much as possible, wear a lightweight long-sleeve shirt or pants. There are numerous clothing lines now that contain SPF. That is helpful because a shirt in general will provide only an SPF of 8, so rarely people can still get sunburned even through a shirt. So making sure you're using sunscreen, and then if you're going to be in the sun a lot, which you should really try to avoid while you're undergoing cancer treatment, but just keep in mind there are SPF clothing lines now. And then as much as possible, wear a wide-brimmed hat and sunglasses. And then finally, just to talk about quality of life concerns, it's important to feel open in talking to your healthcare team about any concerns. So this includes quality of life issues. Quality of life means that even though you're battling cancer, you want to feel like it's not beyond what you can handle. You still want to have a good quality of living. You know, a lot of times that simply means doing normal activities of daily living, like getting up out of bed, eating, doing things that you enjoy. Of course, sometimes there are times when that is difficult, but having a good quality of life means that those difficult times are temporary and overall you still feel like you have a good quality of living. If there are certain side effects that are severe that are interfering with your quality of life, for example, severe mucositis in which you can't eat or severe diarrhea, you should talk to your healthcare team about making adjustments to your treatment plan or sometimes temporarily holding on your treatment until your symptoms improve. And the main point is that you should feel open and willing to talk about your concerns to your healthcare team and feel comfortable in working together to benefit your health. So that is what my comments were for today. I thank you for your attention, and I will turn the call back to Dr. Messner.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Choi. That was really excellent and very helpful in terms of just caring for your skin during immunotherapy treatment, so thank you. And our next speaker is Wynn Burkle, and Mr. Burkle is an oncology social worker. He's director of social service in Long Island, and he's our lung cancer program coordinator for cancer care. And Mr. Burkle is going to address Cancer Care's free psychosocial programs and services, the role of support groups, and stress management tips for all of you. So I'm going to turn this program over to Mr. Burkle.
Thank you, Carolyn. I'm sure most of us remember the time we moved into our first new home, or even our last new home. And I'm sure we wondered how we were ever going to find our way in this new community or neighborhood. Many of us were fortunate enough to get a visit from the welcome wagon, or maybe a very helpful neighbor who helped us find the nearest supermarket, service station, house of worship, school, and all the other services so essential to support our daily lives. The more things we were able to connect to in our neighborhood, the more we felt that we really had things under control. Well, you know, being diagnosed with lung cancer is in some ways very much like moving into a new neighborhood. Our cancer pushes us into a strange and sometimes scary new environment, and we really don't know where anything is and what we can do to get some control over a very difficult change in our lives. Cancer Care, in the role of that good neighbor, provides its popular website, lungcancer.org, to better serve people like you. Rather than burden folks with heavy medical jargon, lungcancer.org has been designed as a first stop for people who find themselves in the new and strange neighborhood of lung cancer. Using simple-to-understand language in a very user-friendly web page format, lungcancer.org helps patients and those who care for them learn about the basic facts on lung cancer and its treatment. And there is a special section on clinical trials, which not only helps one learn what they're all about, but also provides a special search tool which can assist in finding the lung cancer clinical trial that matches each patient's individual situation. And if a patient wishes to become involved in a clinical trial, there is a tool that allows them to connect with a specially trained clinical trials manager to help them with that whole process. In addition, lungcancer.org serves as an easy entrance to connect with the many services which Cancer Care has available free of charge for lung cancer patients and those who care for them. Such services include educational services. Cancer Care's impressive array of Connect Education workshops provide both disease-specific information, such as what we're hearing in today's workshop, as well as workshops on coping with the physical and emotional impact of lung cancer. Replays of these workshops are available both online at Cancer Care's website, www.cancercare.org, and via your phone. Many folks find it convenient to download these replays to their iPods and MP3 players and read them on the bus or the train when they're commuting. Cancer Care's well-known Cancer Care Connect booklets are available free of charge and are packed with up-to-date information on treatments and the latest coping strategies to help cancer patients and those who care for them. We're delighted to have distributed millions of these very popular publications. Cancer Care's website at www.cancercare.org provides a wealth of information on cancer topics and serves as an easy-to-use entry point to Cancer Care's many services. While one is at our website, they can sign up for our free monthly e-newsletter or catch up with our latest informative CopeLink blogs. Cancer Care offers helpful support services, which are provided by its professionally trained staff of experienced oncology social workers, who are there to assist folks like you in dealing with the many issues which arise from the diagnosis of lung cancer, including assistance with emotional issues, in which they assess clients' emotional needs and provide appropriate helpful interventions, assistance with practical issues, such as financial assistance through Cancer Care's limited financial assistance program and referrals to the Cancer Care Copay Foundation and other financial assistance resources. Resource referral, in which our social workers refer folks to the many organizations and agencies established to help cancer patients. Assistance in navigating the system, in which Cancer Care social workers assist people in understanding how to best manage the many new relationships involved in healthcare, and communications, in which our workers are skilled at helping folks learn how to best communicate with their healthcare providers, employers, friends, and family members about their new situation. Cancer Care social workers provide this assistance in a variety of friendly settings, such as at Cancer Care's national office and its regional offices in the tri-state New York metropolitan area, where folks can receive individual and group counseling face-to-face, over the phone, where people from across the nation can find immediate assistance by contacting the Cancer Care helpline at 1-800-813-HOPE, and longer-term assistance through individual telephone counseling with a Cancer Care social worker, as well as connecting with other people in professionally facilitated telephone support groups, and online, where people from across the country share concerns in professionally led online support groups, which are available 24/7 for participants. Our popular support groups, whether for patient or caregiver, and whether experienced in face-to-face, online, or telephone modalities, provide the group members with a safe place to share the burdens, feelings, and stress of the role of caregiver or patient with who are involved in a very similar situation. There's no need to explain yourself in a support group. They know what you're talking about. Group members share wonderfully helpful tips and information on how to best cope with their lung cancer situation. So many of our support group members talk about belonging to that special family which helps them live with lung cancer each day. Members often discuss the stress that they're experiencing and how they're able to reduce it with such techniques as staying in the moment, staying with the facts, just the facts, and plain old talking, talking, and talking about their stressors. The professional facilitative skills of cancer care social workers ensure that each support group is maintained as a special place for each and every member. Call us today to learn more about this wonderful resource. You know, I'm sure none of us ever expected to find ourselves moved to the neighborhood of lung cancer. But now that you're here, be assured that cancer care, like that good neighbor, is there with you. Connect with us at www.cancercare.org or calling us at 1-800-813-HOPE. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much, Wynn. It was excellent. Thank you, and a really excellent description of all of our services. And now we have time for questions. We have a lot of time for questions. I'm going to ask Stephanie to bring all of our speakers on board, and actually she'll give you directions of how to queue up and ask questions. We're going to try to take as many of your questions as possible. If we do not get to your question, then we will simply give you information about calling a number at the end of the call to connect for additional help with your questions. But let's see if we can take most of your questions now. So, Stephanie?
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. If you would like to ask a question, please press star then one on your touchtone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking ask a question. Again, please press star then one to ask a question.
And we have a question from one of our online participants, from Mary. Can nivolumab be given as third-line treatment after docetaxel as second line? Dr. Wakeley, could you address that question?
Sure, that's a great question. So the studies with nivolumab and lung cancer that have been presented recently, the phase 3 trials, looked at nivolumab versus docetaxel, predominantly in the second line, but there were some third-line patients also. And so we certainly can prescribe nivolumab for patients who have already had docetaxel. So that would be fine. It's second line or third line, and perhaps even later line for people who have had other therapies. So, the specific labeling is for second and third.
So a similar question, how long can this be given and indefinitely or until progression or adverse effects? Could you address that as well?
That's another great question about how long do we give these drugs. With chemotherapy, we typically like to think about a specific number of cycles. And then in more recent years with chemotherapy, we've been giving more maintenance where we just keep going as long as the drug seems to be helping someone and not arbitrarily stopping. And so with the newer immunotherapies, it's that same idea. As long as the drug seems to be helping, we keep going. With some of the earlier work with the drugs, it was thought that maybe we should stop after a year, but now we have, for the most part, continued going. As long as the drugs are helping and there's no significant side effect, we keep going.
Excellent. Thank you. And one of our questions, one of our participants, from one of our online participants, is immuno-oncology is currently not part of my lung cancer treatment. Should I ask my current doctor about this or find a specialist near me? Dr. Wakeley, could you address that question?
Sure, that's a great question. And it brings up, actually, one of the things I didn't talk about is that these drugs are not for everybody. The major reason we wouldn't give an immune therapy to a patient would be if that person has another autoimmune disease. And given what we talked about, that should make sense because the major side effects of these drugs is they can bring on autoimmune reactions. So if a patient already has an autoimmune disease like rheumatoid arthritis, like lupus, like myasthenia gravis, if we were to give them an autoimmune-inducing drug potentially, like the PD-1 or PD-L1 drugs, that could make that disease much, much worse. And so anyone with any sort of underlying autoimmune disease would not be allowed to get one of these drugs. For most other patients, these would be things to think about. However, if you're on a therapy now that's working, we would not encourage people to stop something that they know is working to go with one of these drugs. While they're very hopeful and encouraging, they're not working for all patients. Just like with chemotherapy, sometimes they work very, very well, and sometimes they don't work as well. So if a patient is on a therapy that is working for them, regardless of whether it's good old-fashioned chemotherapy or a targeted drug or something else, we would never encourage people to stop that active therapy to go towards one of these new agents. We're hopeful that they would be working well, and there's a lot of work being done to try to make them work better by combining them with other drugs, but they're still not a perfect solution for everyone.
That's excellent. Thank you. And we have one of our people on the telephone asking a question. Stephanie?
Our question comes from Rigla R. Your line is open.
Hello?
Hi. We'd like to take your question, certainly.
Hello?
Hello, did you have a question?
Yes. Hello?
Yes, your question is?
Okay, my question is, my sister, she has small lung cancer, and her oncologist is thinking about giving her Avastin and Doxil. I'm trying to find out what major role would that play in minimizing the cell growth.
And what type of lung cancer does she have?
She has also clear cell ovarian cancer and small cell cancer.
Okay, So with the small cell lung cancer, there are a lot of different options being used. And at the meeting we just had, there were presentations about these immune-targeted drugs in small cell, but they're not yet approved in that setting, so it's something that we're looking at. As far as other active drugs, there are a lot of active drugs in small cell lung cancer, and so that would really be a good question to talk with her oncologist specifically about that. But the chemotherapy drugs in general do stop cell growth, and the bevacizumab or Avastin drug has been shown to add to chemotherapy in a lot of different forms of lung cancer, not always used in small cell. So an important thing to talk with her oncologist more about.
Excellent. Thank you. And we have another question from our online participants. If the immunology treatment does not work, can the person be started on the traditional chemotherapy? So, Dr. Wakely, could you address that?
So another great question with the idea of, well, we've been hearing today about these immune-targeted drugs, and the question really has to do with how do we sequence them. We've talked about using them after chemotherapy. What about before chemotherapy? What about moving to chemotherapy afterwards? So those are very good questions. So I'm going to step back and I'll get to the specific question, but we don't yet know how active these drugs are for patients who have never had chemotherapy. So far, the data we have is limited in small numbers. It looks encouraging. It looks like maybe these drugs are going to be as good as chemotherapy or almost as good as chemotherapy for people who have never had chemo. There was some presentation at this ASCO meeting just recently looking at combining some of these drugs with chemotherapy, and some of those results looked very encouraging. For right now, the approvals are for patients who've already had chemotherapy and then get one of the immune-targeted agents. The specific question was, well, what about patients who've already had an immune-targeted agent? It's done what it's going to do, and they now need additional treatment. Going back to chemotherapy afterwards is perfectly reasonable thing to try. There's a lot of work being done trying to sort out the specifics about, well, there's some chemos working better than others, what kind of responses should we expect, and we don't have those answers yet, but we do believe that having an immune therapy would not limit your ability to get later chemotherapy.
Excellent. Thank you. We have a really wonderful question. So wonderful audience today. We also have a question from another online participant. And the question is, is the flu vaccine safe for me to receive if I'm also receiving immunotherapy? So if you could address that, Dr. Wakely.
So that is a great question, and that should be fine. The flu vaccine is not a live virus vaccine. And so it would be perfectly fine to get while you're getting immune therapy. We do get a little bit concerned about some of the live virus vaccines, like the shingles vaccine, for people getting chemotherapy. And I honestly don't believe that's been looked at as closely with these agents so far. But for flu vaccine, not a problem.
Is there a live vaccine for flu that they would not want to get as well? Isn't there a...
The nasal one, yeah, that wouldn't be the best idea.
Excellent, okay. And then there's another question about just exercise. Will I be able to exercise and perform my daily activities while undergoing immunotherapy treatment for my lung cancer?
So that's another great question, and of course it's a very much an individual question, and since I'm not seeing the individual who asked that specific question, I can't tell them specifically, but in general, people who are getting immune therapies are able to function fairly well. There might be some increase in fatigue, but they'll be able to stay active. Actually, one of my patients who's on immune therapy, he's a Zumba instructor, and he's still able to work as a Zumba instructor, so...
So that's excellent to hear. Wow, that's so, but it is actually, so actually, of course, one has to take these questions. And often, you know, these calls are a great opportunity to ask a question here as a practice run, then to go back to your treating healthcare team. You have a bit of information, but then it has to be tailored to your specific needs. So kind of ask away, and we'll do the best we can, but then we know you must go back to your treating team to ask them as well.
Excellent.
So another question, what are some short-term side effects to be aware of compared with long-term side effects with immunotherapy? Is that something we know about at this point?
Very good question about the short-term versus long-term. So in the short-term, while people are on these drugs, it's the fatigue that becomes the biggest concern, as we've talked about. And that, again, isn't for all people, but can be there. These immune toxicities that we've talked about, the rare side effects, the ones that we dread, though, those can happen in the short term. So people can develop those within the first couple of doses of these drugs if they're going to happen. And when they do happen, usually with steroids and potentially stopping the drugs, those can improve and resolve. Some of the toxicities, though, if they happen, such as the ones that hit the endocrine function, like the thyroid or the pituitary, adrenal, again, very, very rare. But when those happen, they don't always reverse when the drugs are stopped or steroids are given. So that would be the only potential long-term, but again, very, very rare.
And we have another question from one of our online participants. I have just found out that the type of lung cancer I have is KRAS stage 4. Besides chemo, is there any other treatment that I could try?
So that's really getting at this idea of targeted therapy, which has been one of the very exciting developments in the last decade in our treatment of lung cancer. And Dr. Choi talked about some of the targeted agents in relation to the skin toxicities of those. We didn't really talk about them in the efficacy standpoint, but a big part of what we do in treating lung cancer now, especially the non-small cell, is look to see if we can find specific what we call driver mutations, a genetic change that's led to the cancer, and a genetic change that's only in the cancer, not in the rest of the person. So the ones that people have heard about the most are EGFR, epidermal growth factor receptor, because they're very good pill drugs that work when we find that mutation, which is in about 10% of non-small cell lung cancers. ALK is another one we've heard a lot about because they're treatments. KRAS is actually the most common, and there are some very exciting clinical trials ongoing for KRAS, going after different components of that pathway, but none that are yet approved. And so when I'm treating a patient with a KRAS mutation in their lung cancer, we usually will start with traditional chemotherapies, and many patients with KRAS do well with standard chemotherapies like pemetrexed or the taxanes with platinum. The immune-targeted drugs seem to be working well in patients with KRAS, not necessarily better than with other particular mutations, but just as well. So that's a very good option for sort of second line or beyond. And then keeping an eye out for clinical trials, talking with your care team about what options might be available locally that could add to the standard treatment, such as chemotherapy and now targeted immune therapies.
Excellent. And we have a question actually for Wynn. I'm a caregiver for a family member with lung cancer. Do you have any stress management recommendations or tips for me? Wynn, could you address that? Because the caregivers, of course, are so vitally important, and they're often on our calls.
Yeah, I think one of the techniques that is discussed so often in our groups is the technique of staying in the moment or one day at a time. It's very, very often easy as a caregiver or a patient to kind of cast ahead into what's happened to the future and what's going to happen in the future. And we put a tremendous amount of energy sometimes in trying to solve problems that we don't know are ever going to come about. It causes a great deal of stress. So the group members often help each other and to sort of come back to today, stay with today. You've got enough on your plate today. Why put energy into something that we don't know about and that we certainly can't solve? And stay with the problems of today. And it tends to reduce that stress load. A corollary technique is stay with the facts. Oftentimes what happens is that we create some worst-case scenarios. We come up with things that aren't facts, and we become very, very stressed over them. And it's important to stay with the facts that we know. Stay with what is current today. Don't worry about what's going to happen on the next scan. We know what happened on the last scan. We know exactly where we are. Stay with that. When we get to that next scan, that's the time to apply our energy. And following that type of stay technique can be very helpful in reducing the stress load.
Excellent. And one last question here from one of our online participants. Mutation testing in squamous non-small cell lung cancer since no targeted treatments. Dr. Wakely, can you address this?
Well, with squamous, so the understanding of the molecular changes that lead to lung cancer have gone further so far with adenocarcinoma, where we've been able to identify those mutations in almost half of patients when we look with enough techniques. And so that has led to changes in therapy for a lot of patients with adenocarcinoma. With squamous cell carcinoma, we've been able to identify mutations in a lot of those tumors, but fewer of them have had good targets available, meaning that we can find the gene that's the problem, but we just don't have the right drugs yet to treat that. However, there's a very big clinical trial ongoing throughout the United States right now through the cooperative group systems for patients with squamous cell histology as their type of lung cancer, where they do sequencing of the tumor, and then depending on what's found, people can go into various specific treatment with drugs that are targeted against the mutation that might be there. And for people where they aren't able to find a mutation that's targetable, then they can get some of the different immune therapy drugs. So while it's been slower than what we've seen with adenocarcinoma, we are making headway in understanding the molecular changes in squamous cell, and that's going to lead to better treatments in the future. It's just been slower.
Excellent. Thank you. I want to thank you very much. I want to thank our speakers. You've been extraordinary, actually, just amazing speakers. And I also want to thank all of you who've queued up and asked such great questions, both online and on the telephone. I do want to remind you all that this is a one-hour program and that in planning a program like this, we know that you have many, many needs that go far beyond the scope of this 1 hour. So we hope that this 1 hour will give you some information to take back to your treating healthcare teams, to give you information as well, to ask more informed questions. And we also hope you'll take advantage of our services, Cancer Care. If you have any emotional or social or practical questions, please do call Cancer Care at 1-800-813-HOPE. And if you have medically focused questions, questions that you really want to ask an information specialist, a cancer information specialist, I would suggest you call the National Cancer Institute at 1-800-422-6237. And their information specialists are always waiting for your calls right after our teleconferences. They actually have this kind of expertise there to address any of your medical questions that you didn't get to ask. I want to thank you all for your participation today, and I want you also, most importantly as we conclude, I don't want you to think that you're alone. I know sometimes people feel that they're alone, but I want you to know that you're now part of this Cancer Care family, and that to some extent, we're here to help you. And we're simply a telephone call away at 1-800-813-HOPE. Again, thank you all for your participation today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may now disconnect, and everyone have a wonderful day.